I should begin by explaining the term linguistic turn in a very general way, because some of you may, coming more from the Indology or Sanskrit side, may not be aware of what it means or what its history is. Around the beginning of the 20th century, a determined effort was made by Bertrand Russell and other philosophers to make philosophy analytical, to turn a hitherto predominantly speculative branch of knowledge into something more rigorous, something similar to the role mathematics plays in the sciences. As a gradual outcome of such insistence on methodological rigor arose the doctrine of logical positivism. It had two elements in addition to respect for scientific method. A, the assumption that insofar as philosophical problems are genuine at all, they can definitely be solved by logical analysis, and B, metaphysics is to be totally rejected. Out of the first element grew the tendency to pay more and more attention to the language in which philosophical problems were expressed and discussed. It was gradually realized that most or all philosophical problems are a result either of the inadequacy of ordinary language or of inattention to how expressions are actually used. This realization culminated in the writings of Wittgenstein in the form, philosophical problems are not to be solved, but to be dissolved. This became a kind of slogan. Those who saw the philosophical issues arising out of the inadequacy or non-transparent character of ordinary language busied themselves with constructing ideal or scientific languages, trying to cure the misuse in the ordinary. On the other hand, those who thought the philosophers misused the language by failing to understand the actual use of crucial expressions proceeded to analyze philosophical usage, painstakingly submitting expression after expression to examination. These two tendencies, as well as some of the earlier philosophical stances, are still very much in vogue. As a result of their interaction, several intermediary positions have also been taken. The philosophical scene has indeed become complex, but the recognition of language as an important factor here is one of the common factors to the developments. And this has been introduced in a book that has now become rather old, Richard Rorty's book called The Linguistic Turn. And it was published in 1967. It's not exactly his book, it's an anthology, but the introduction surveys what I have just now summarized. With the introduction of Chomsky and linguistics, the field of approaching philosophy linguistically became even more interesting, and it continues to flourish, particularly in Britain and North America. Frequently it's referred to as Anglo-American School of Philosophy to distinguish it from the continental schools of philosophy. As Karl H. Potter observes in his masterly introduction to the Philosophy of Nyayavaisheshika, Volume 2 of the Encyclopedia of Indian Philosophies, the linguistic turn took place many centuries ago in India. So what we see happening at the beginning of the 20th century, according to Potter, happened long time ago. Although this observation is expressed in impressive words and is essentially correct, much work needs to be done to determine the history of the turn and the aspects it displayed. Such work will naturally give rise to qualified disagreements with Potter, but this is not the purpose of my presentation today. I think Potter is essentially right, although it would have been nice if he could have expanded on his remark. Perhaps he needs to write another book-length study on this topic. At least one aspect of how the entry of linguistic considerations into Indian traditions of philosophy took place may be said to be non-controversial, although it is not frequently associated specifically with the arisal of the linguistic term itself. This is the aspect of having to do with the Vedic tradition. It is generally agreed that in some distant past, a significant section of the then cultural leaders of India agreed that the Vedas had to be preserved as they were heard or recited. In the effort to preserve the Vedas, much devoted and loving care was bestowed on phonetics, word derivation, meaning derivation, and hermeneutics, in short, to a number of linguistic sciences. This made the educated populace of ancient India very much sensitive to the niceties of the Vedic and Sanskrit language continuum. The thinkers generated by such populace, including the philosophers, were naturally all the more prone to reflect over how they were saying what they were saying. This is definitely one aspect of the linguistic turn in Indian history. The second aspect is, again, rooted in the Vedic tradition ultimately. It's also even less commonly emphasized. Right from the days of some of the earliest Vedic compositions, we find an unusual interest on the part of the composers, at least some of whom talk like mystics, in the phenomenon of language. Language or vach is personified, glorified, and even deified. Her various aspects or profiles are alluded to, and it is conceded that she is only partially encountered or comprehended and remains a source of enticement. Now, there are indications in the surviving evidence that such an engagement with language has been there all along, right from the Vedic times to our own days, among practicing mystics, particularly the practitioners of various types of yoga, such as Nada Yoga, Shabda Yoga, etc. It is not impossible that Indian culture's retention of this engagement influenced traditional India's philosophers, and along with the Vedic educational phenomenon I have spoken about, created an intellectual climate conducive to the emergence of philosophy alert to the signals of language. Today I will try to describe what I see as the relatively early stage of linguistic turn in Indian history, and I will try to do it in a sort of controlled way that experiments are generally conducted. I will seek to establish that the linguistic turn we are talking about was primarily and extensively brought about in the Indian tradition, first by the Vaiyakaranas, or analyzers of language, or grammarians. Further, among the extant grammar works, it is in the text concerned with explaining the theoretical basis of Panini's grammar, the so-called Arthagranthas, or texts devoted to semantics in the Paninian tradition, that we first see explicit and reasoned statements on topics of fundamental relevance to linguistic philosophy. Questions of sentence unity, etc., that the Mimamsakas, the Vedic exegetes, raised, the mental or conceptual reality that the Buddhists probed, and the attention yoga gave to mind probably did help, among possibly other things, in furthering the linguistic approach. But it is the grammarians concerned with semantics and the theoretical basis of Panini's grammar who, as far as I know, explore for the first time in any sustained way the implications of their findings in the area of language to problems of knowing and existence. The first currently accessible evidence of this accomplishment of the grammarians is found in the Mahabhashya of Patanjali, not later than 2nd century BC, but the evidence really becomes undeniable for the first time, as far as we know at present, in the Trikandi or Vakyapadiya of Bhartrihari, not later than 425 AD. The rise of classical Indian linguistic philosophy thus seems to be more from the side of grammar or linguistics than from the side of philosophy. In this respect, it differs from its counterpart in the West. The other philosopher, whom I will pick up for the controlled experiment I mentioned just now, will be Nagarjuna. For choosing Nagarjuna, my reason is that he has, in the last few decades, attracted much more philosophical explication than Bhartrihari, and in that explication, either it has been asserted or an impression has been created that Nagarjuna is a deconstructionist and has dissolved philosophical problems linguistically. He has been compared with several Western philosophers of the recent past, such as Whitehead and Wittgenstein, as well as with ancient Greek philosophers such as Zeno. It has also been suggested by some that Nagarjuna's work, while coming at the beginning of whatever survives of systematic Indian philosophy, also represents its culmination. He has been seen as an unusually subtle and sophisticated philosopher. It occurred to me that if I studied this philosopher, who seems to be earlier than Bhartrihari by a few hundred years, I shall have a good comparative handle to assess how the linguistic approach to philosophical issues developed in India. Furthermore, Nagarjuna has been interpreted in confusingly different ways. One gets the feeling that some of his interpretations reveal more about the interpreters than about him. A better sense of how Indian philosophy developed in the early centuries of the Christian era will help us in deciding which interpretation or interpretations of Nagarjuna have a better chance of being historically valid. We may then have a tool to control and evaluate the interpretations of Nagarjuna. In the limited comparative historical frame I have thus adopted, I am at first going to move in the reverse chronological direction from Bhartrihari to Nagarjuna, for as indicated just now, the awareness of the linguistic approach is evidenced in Bhartrihari, whereas in Nagarjuna it is not. Having a precise understanding of a definite Indian version of the linguistic approach will help us in deciding what to look for in Nagarjuna. Otherwise, we run the risk of being guided only by elements specific to modern Western philosophy and missing some of the other possible angles of looking at Nagarjuna. In following the discussion about to ensue, you should also bear in mind that the dichotomy between philosophical linguistic, which is so sharp for the recent Western tradition, is not to be found in an equally sharp form in the Indian philosophical tradition. There, the division of knowledge into branches is naturally different. Consequently, the distinction between linguistic philosophy, that is, language-dominated philosophy, and philosophy of language is not to be found in Bhartrihari's writings. For him, the theory of language and grammar, that is, philosophy of language, was a darshana, a view of reality, in the full sense of the term, and hence it already included linguistic philosophy, that is, philosophy with a linguistic term. In pre-modern India, there were no separate words for these fields of intellectual activity. Also, thinkers were generally not inhibited by the labels attached to disciplines and did not hesitate to move from one area to the other if the logic of their thinking warranted it. It would therefore be unjustifiable to expect in Bhartrihari a statement like, "Look here, fellow philosophers, I am now going to base your usual business on a different language-oriented footing." The evidence to the effect that this is what he is actually doing is bound to be indirect. Another consideration to be noted is that although Bhartrihari sets out to achieve what the modern linguistic philosophy seeks to achieve, the manner of achievement is not the same. Modern linguistic philosophers have been mostly particularistic. Most of their philosophization comes to a stop after discussing the problems of transcribing particular expressions in the ideal languages or after discussing the use of particular expressions in ordinary language. Bhartrihari, on the other hand, gives us a general theory of language, general theory of semantics, and he applies, as he is expounding it, to whatever problems we would consider as typically philosophical problems. What is the evidence to suppose that Bhartrihari approached philosophical problems through language, that he attempted to philosophize, keeping in mind the nature of language? Some of this evidence I have already given in some of the publications I have produced over the last several years. But as we go along, the evidence will be clear to you that Bhartrahari's treatment of problems of cause and effect, of motion, of ontology, discussing concepts of realistic philosophers such as the Vaisheshikas, for example, the concept of Samavaya, is very much linguistic. And as I said in my presentation earlier this afternoon, incidentally, Bhartrahari, instead of discarding these views, tries to show how they could be accommodated in different corners of the mansion of philosophy. The key aspect of Bhartrahari's linguistic approach is his establishment of a theory of word meaning. Through extensive argument in different parts of his work, he establishes that word meaning is primarily a mental entity. There need not always be a physical thing or action corresponding to it. Shabdartha, you have these words on the second part of the handout. Shabdartha on the one hand and Bahyartha or Vastvartha on the other, to adopt the terms mentioned in his work, must be distinguished. Nor should word meaning be understood simply as an image in the sense an entity possessing or reflecting a specific shape. It is ultimately characterizable merely as an entity in the mind that is signified by and thought to be distinct from the word. Then, however, there remains no ground to suppose that it truly exists as an entity in its own right. Its distinct existence, that is, the distinct existence of meaning, must be said to be a fiction created by our usage. As one cannot speak of it without tentatively assuming its existence and without mentally separating it from the linguistic unit, one is led to believe in its existence and consequently sees distinctions between those cognitions in which meanings appear or are understood and those cognitions which reflect linguistic units or word forms. In reality, both these types of cognitions, according to Bhartrahari, are infused with linguistic units. Only the view we take differs. In the final analysis, therefore, meaning turns out to be one with the signifying entity. On a higher level, it is cast off. On the level of usage, it is retained. The outcome of this line of reasoning is that we need to assume only the linguistic units or the impressions of linguistic expressions as the constituents of mind. Those units contain meanings. Meanings contain the subset of ideas, concepts, etc. And ideas, concepts, etc. contain the subset of images of external physical things. We retain all these categories of entities in the form of linguistic units and mentally distinguish them from the signifying linguistic units. This view of meaning is the basis of Bhartrahari's ontology as a philosopher. If the assumption is that a person has not become the language principle, has not achieved moksha in or Brahma Prapti in some way, and that there is no that there is no spiritual liberation, just worldly existence, only the physical things and the language principle are admitted in Bhartrahari's ontology. All other entities which are cognized in separation from the things and which can be characterized either as mental or linguistic constructs or as capacities of the language principle are disposed of by accepting their ultimate oneness either with the physical things or the language principle. Thus, the different phases of a thing, collections or combinations, absence of a physical thing, capabilities or powers of shaktis of a thing, relations between things, qualities, gunas, attributes, universals, jati, numbers, sankhya, all are said to be different ways of approaching the physical thing that the language principle adopts. And so there is the physical things can be viewed either as a collective presence of all these potentialities, or as an essential thing which cannot be seen without bringing one of these aspects into play. On the other hand, all this activity needs a force, some kind of shakti again, that will introduce differentiation. This force is twofold: the force of time and the force of space. So whatever distinctions we see in physical things or mental concepts have at the back lying a notion of time and space. So time and space are taken as inherent capabilities of the language principle. Just as the language principle is assumed to be an undeniable part of our existence, as something like consciousness or sentience, it is these two capabilities are taken as inseparable from the language principle, and they in interaction with physical things introduce the diversity that we see in our actual world. It should be evident from this account, as well as from Bhartrihari's discussion of cause and effect relationship, etc., that Bhartrihari did gain an insight of the crucial relation between philosophizing and language at least 14 centuries ahead of our modern philosophers. He carried forward that insight in a fundamental and thorough manner, perhaps in too radical a manner for the modern taste, but consistent with the ability of Sanskrit philosophers to transform traditions from within and carry views to their logical end. Now let us turn to the other thinker who also carries his views to their logical end. Nagarjuna, one of Bhartrihari's illustrious predecessors, and probably the most difficult philosopher to explain in a limited amount of time. Bhartrihari in all probability knew Nagarjuna's work. There is one verse, particularly in the third book of the third chapter of the third book, in which a reference to Nagarjuna seems to be intended. Sato Higantur Gamanam, where Nagarjuna's famous example, to which I'll come, is meant. Given the wide variety of interpretations of Nagarjuna, to which I have alluded already. What I am going to do is to follow a certain methodological principle explicitly, as you can see from the handout item 3. What I have done is to note first the statements that define the boundaries and give us the anchors of Nagarjuna's thinking. This is what I try to do whenever I see a lot of secondary literature on a philosopher and I want to understand that philosopher as accurately as possible. I keep all those interpretations aside and just analyze the text and try to see this is what the philosopher is definitely saying, what interpretation would be would fit the definite indications, the explicit statements made by that philosopher. To that extent, it's also possible that the philosopher could be inconsistent, but we should try it for a charitable reading and gave him the wherever he has not been explicit, we try to determine the extent to which he could have wavered or been inconsistent or have been consistent, in fact. So you will see here that what I have done on the handout is to give an original from Nagarjuna's work and what that signifies. And I have six statements of Nagarjuna that in my view, should be observed as guidance posts by anyone trying to interpret Nagarjuna. Now, I will give you a quick walk through these principles. The philosophy of Nagarjuna can be summarized simply as: all is quiet on the religio-philosophical front. There is no created entity, There is no entity that has come into being as such. This is what Nagarjuna is definitely saying. Whether by entity we mean things, physical things, bhavas, mental relatives of things, roughly speaking concepts and psychic reactions, dharmas, or nirvana. Everything is at rest without the duality or separation that creation coming into existence implies. Now it will naturally be asked why this message, which can be stated so simply and which is undoubtedly there in Nagarjuna's own words, leads to so much writing on him and makes him one of the most controversial philosophers in terms of interpretation as well as evaluation. The reasons are many and interesting. They pertain to Nagarjuna, to us as readers of his thought, and to the very process of interpretation. The effect Nagarjuna's seemingly simple pronouncement eventually has upon us is equal to the effect we would experience if someone suddenly removed, right from under our feet, the very scaffolding or ground on which we may be standing. It boggles the mind that the philosophical pursuit of truth culminates in the message, destroy all philosophical and philosophy-like structures. It shocks us when we realize that a person who is supposed to be a Buddhist thinker is telling us that Buddhism never came into being, that there never was a Buddha, that nirvana is neither lost nor achieved. However, while these factors, roughly speaking, of an emotional or affective sort, do influence our studies of Nagarjuna, it should not be supposed that they alone are responsible for making Nagarjuna a difficult thinker to comprehend. The nagging question that even a philosophically calm mind would face is about the truth value of the pronouncement itself. How do we test that the pronouncement of Nagarjuna is valid? The only structure we have for such testing, logico-philosophical thinking, probing, or exploration, has now been rendered utterly suspect, as it implicitly assumes created, that is, ultimately non-existent distinctions. We have not been given any other structure. Even if we were given one, it would not, as something created, remain in existence at the moment validation or verification of the Nagarjunian truth takes place. Thus, the simple pronouncement leads to the ultimate paradox, which is utterly absurd but utterly irrefutable, if I were to borrow a phrase from A.L. Hermann's book used in a different context. Secondly, when Nagarjuna says that there is no created entity, does he mean to say that there is one original, uncreated, undiversified entity on the background of which the big joke of our diversified existence takes place? Or does he mean to say that there is no such backdrop, that nothing has ever existed, that the joke is crueler than we took it to be? Nagarjuna, as some experts of his thought have emphasized, refuses to answer, because our question is a part of the joke too. But this jocular existence is all that we have got, and the structures of thought which we have sharpened in that existence are all that we have to make some kind of determination. If Nagarjuna is telling us not to attempt a determination, his starting point and our starting point have been different right from the beginning. We were interested in philosophy, a rational determination. He obviously was not. If he is telling us not to attempt determination because, using our starting point, he has proved it to be futile, he has made philosophy stand on its head, then he has destroyed the only instrument we had and given us nothing in its place. Besides, we still need to determine if Nagarjuna has really proved our very attempt to determine futile. If he has really destroyed our only instrument, taken away our last candy, how can we carry out this second overarching determination? I'm sure by now you can see how the simple pronouncement with which I introduced Nagarjuna's thought is a nest of complexities of a fundamental sort, and how for philosophers, as distinct from students of religion, the question of Nagarjuna's method is of vital importance, a real bread and butter issue. However, in the sprawling literature on Nagarjuna, even if one confines oneself to articles and books written by philosophers for philosophers, the attention given to Nagarjuna's method as distinct from his message is relatively little. Furthermore, in whatever attention his method has received, the dominant idiom is that of logic, although this logic frequently appeals to linguistic considerations. Even when linguistically oriented logic is used, it is generally assumed that Nagarjuna is using a linguistic analytic method knowingly, and that while the method may not be perfect, there is no reason to doubt that it is linguistic in its essence or thrust. In addition to the questioning of what the real and overall nature of the method is, something else is missing: situating of the method historically in the larger context of methodologies displayed by philosophers in the Sanskrit tradition. True, there are excellent studies, especially by Murthy, Matilal, Strang, Goodman Sen, and others, which explain this method, but critical examination and calm evaluation of that method are somehow lagging behind. Richard Robinson, Richard Jones, and Strafford Beatty have attempted the examination and evaluation. In more recent times, Richard Hayes, Klaus Oetker, John Tabor have dealt with the method and with logic or fallacy as the focal point. But generally, Robinson's brilliant article of 1972 and Jones's insightful article of 1978 are hardly ever referred to in the general and in many ways helpful literature on Nagarjuna. The overall impression created is that Nagarjuna is too subtle or advanced or clever to suffer any damage from his partial detractors. The elephant will continue to walk ahead majestically while the dogs bark from the sidelines. I do not begrudge Nagarjuna the admiration and adulation he is receiving. After all, he is not at the same university as I am. He deserves it in a certain respect, as I will point out. However, I also think that the Nagarjuna idol or pratima needs to be put up in as accurate a historical setting as the available evidence would allow. Hence, I will today attempt to offer a different criticism of Nagarjuna's method from the one that is available in the writings of Robinson, Jones, Beatty, and Hayes. Besides being strongly indicated in the tradition and being helpful in interpreting Nagarjuna in a historically justifiable way, my angle of criticism will probably explain why readers of Nagarjuna react to him in opposite ways, why some consider him to be philosopher par excellence, and some declare him to be a practitioner of sophistry. Let us at this stage see an illustration of Nagarjuna's method of argumentation. I have deliberately selected a passage, item 4 on the handout, which needs no explanation of the background. Which is entirely secular in nature, which is frequently used to explain Nagarjuna, which makes the dialectical and paradoxical character of Nagarjuna's method apparent, and which incidentally reminds one almost immediately of Zeno's paradox in the Western tradition. A faithful, yet not literal, rendering of the passage would be as follows. You speak of the act of going or traversing. Where does this act take place? Surely, not with respect to the path that has been traversed. For that which has been traversed is one where the act of traversing has come to an end, is no longer taking place. Traversing with respect to the untraversed or to be traversed part of the path is also not possible, for how can that which is yet to be traversed be undergoing traversing? And there is no third possibility, because a path can only be either traversed or to be traversed. At this point, the opponent says to Nagarjuna, "Come on, Mr. Nagarjuna, the matter cannot be that difficult. Where you see the movement, that is where traversing is taking place. And since the movement is located in that part which is being traversed, traversing is located in that part which is being traversed, neither in the traverse nor in the untraversed. In response, Nagarjuna says, how can you say that that which is being traversed comes to possess traversing? Would it ever be without traversing? When you attribute traversing to that which is being traversed, you imply that it was originally not being traversed, that it was originally without the attribute of traversing. If, on the other hand, you say that such is not the case, then that which is being traversed ends up with two traversings. One traversing which made it an entity being traversed, and another traversing which you now attribute to it. Now, if you have two traversings, you will have two traversers, for there cannot be a traversing without a traverser. Conversely, if there is no traversing, how can there be a traverser? Furthermore, a traverser is one who is traversing. Why would he proceed to traverse? On the other hand, a non-traverser cannot by definition be one who performs traversing. Now, who other than a traverser and a non-traverser can traverse? I'm sorry to inflict this on you at 5:30 in the afternoon, but thank you for keeping up with it. Applying similar dialectic to other acts and actors and other entities, Nagarjuna argues that they have no independent defining characteristic, no essential feature which would make them what we claim them to be. We must rely on some other equally essenceless concepts to invest them with content. Because in this manner they have no self-establishing mark or swabhava and have invariable dependence on other things, pratitya samutpanna, they are in themselves empty, shunya, and cannot truly be said to have come into existence. Since this is the case, there has never been a ripple in whatever we call existence. It has always been without activity, entirely resting in itself. One can now easily see that, as Robinson emphasized several years ago, the concept of swabhava is the cornerstone of Nagarjuna's philosophical edifice. Jones's discussion indicates that the meaning Nagarjuna assigns to the term swabhava is arbitrary, unjustifiably restrictive, and desire to prove his point kind of meaning. For the Hayes-Traber difference of views too, swabhava is the turning stone on which both wish to stand. However, let me leave here this intricate point and other possible criticisms of Nagarjuna and move on to something that is more relevant to our overall theme today. According to Bhartrihari, an expression like "the traverser traverses" can be accounted for in several ways. The contradiction that Nagarjuna points out between A, referring to the goer as agent, and B, asserting the agent's going, presupposes that the things we refer to must be in existence, that there is no difference between referent and meaning, that language necessarily refers to reality, and there is one-to-one correspondence between language and reality. Is any of these presuppositions valid? Bhartrihari is quite emphatic that such is not the case. Besides, pointing out several reasons for and ways of distinguishing between referent, vastvartha or bahyartha, and meaning, shabdartha or buddhyartha, he also argues at length that it is wrong to think of sentence meaning at the level of actual communication as something constructed out of lexical and grammatical meanings of the constituents. At the level of analysis, one can of course try to ascertain whether the meanings of constituents add up to the meaning understood from the sentence, or if there is a gap between the sentence meaning and the meanings of the constituents, what the extent and nature of that gap is. But the judgments reached in that respect constitute linguistic reality of a secondary and derivative sort. In the primary linguistic reality of communication, the undivided sentence is the unit, the so-called meanings of constituents are indiscernible in a well-integrated whole, and contradictions of the sort pointed out by Nagarjuna do not exist. When someone says the goer goes, it is understood that in that particular sentence we do not take the literal lexical meaning of goer. The sentence context tells us the person who will soon be predicated as performing the action of going is meant as the agent. And that's how he doesn't have to be actually going at that very moment. We utter the word goer and do not utter the rest of the meanings of the sentence, rest of the words of the sentence. So here you will see that how one approaches linguistic quite clearly, and the other is maybe preparing the ground for reaching to to a linguistic approach, but is not quite linguistic. The one other argument I would use to make the same point is that there is hardly any theory of language as such that is explicitly referred to by Nagarjuna. In the works that are generally attributed to him, only in Vigraha Vyavartani, I think, there is one remark he makes that words do not always refer to real things. But that has not been applied to the paradox he creates elsewhere for us. One should, of course, be free to value Nagarjuna as a religious philosopher and be inspired to see more dimensions and deeper or higher truths than seem to come out of his words taken literally. Nor need one seriously doubt his originality or truly reserved great impact within the Buddhist tradition either. His equations like Pratitya Samutpada is equal to Shunyata, or his thesis of two levels of reality, of non-difference between samsara and nirvana, show originality and courage of going where logic will ultimately lead. It is quite likely that an early teaching like Sabbe Dhamma Anatta found a different kind of justification when it became a teaching of Dharma Nairatmya, emptiness of all dharmas, self, devoid of all dharmas are devoid of self, in his hands. He apparently was and will continue to remain an important and original contributor to human thought. But this need not be achieved by ignoring or downplaying the shortcomings of his logic or the relative primitiveness of his analytical philosophical approach. It is not in Nagarjuna's works in Bhartrihari that we for the first time see in surviving classical Indian tradition a clear realization of the capacity of language to affect philosophizing. It is he who definitely shows awareness of the general methodological metaphilosophical principle that language could be interfering in the internal affairs of philosophy as a whole. Just as Zeno's paradoxes were accounted for by Russell and Quine, Nagarjuna's paradoxes, as we have seen, were accounted for, although implicitly, by Bhartrihari. According to Bhartrihari, the so-called paradoxical sentences are not essentially different from other sentences. The wrong approach of not taking the conveyed or intended sentence meaning as the starting point and of thinking sentence meaning as something composed from abstracted or lexical meanings of sub-sentence units can possibly turn any assertion into a paradox. Thus, in Indian as well as Western philosophy, an awareness of the role of language was instrumental in treating the paradoxes properly, and this development took place as philosophy moved from Nagarjuna's time to Bhartrihari's. We also notice that as we approach in time the rise of philosophy like Bhartrihari's, discussion tends to be channeled along the lines of language, shabda, ontology, artha, and epistemology, jnana. This division of philosophical thought does not seem to lie at the bottom of Nagarjuna's philosophical statements, but it surfaces, as far as I can determine, for the first time in Shabarabhashya, Yogabhashya, and Bhartrihari's works. That Shabara or the Yogavasbhashya author preceded Bhartrihari in time has not been proved with absolute certainty, but the indications available in the tradition point in that direction, and I do not see any real justification for questioning the validity of those indications. If what I have said so far is valid, the history of Indian philosophy between the periods of Nagarjuna and Bhartrhari is essentially similar to the history of Western philosophy from the time of David Hume to the present. First, there is a probing of the relationship between cause and effect. It is followed by an increasing awareness of the logical difficulties such a relationship presents. The role of language in giving rise to the difficulties is gradually realized. This leads to attempts to dissolve the difficulties rather than to solve them. The dissolving is attempted first by concentrating on the expressions and entities such as hetu, sat, asat, bhava, abhava, parinama, karana, karana, prayojya, prayojaka, etc., which figure in the discussions of the cause and effect relationship. Then, by concentrating on the nature, syntax, etc., of the sentences expressing the cause and effect relationship, and later by bringing a general theory regarding language to bear upon philosophical problems. In this last stage, the relation of language with cognition and the world we cognize is particularly and intensively explored. So also is the general concept of meaning. In this manner, the stages leading from philosophy to linguistic philosophy and culminated in the meeting of philosophy and philosophy of language are similar and appear in strikingly similar sequence. The development of philosophy from Hume to post-Wittgenstein philosophers in the West is paralleled in broad but interesting features in the period of Indian philosophy from Nagarjuna to Bhartrhari. Thank you. This passage is the clearest evidence we have. That is, it refers to the act of going. It is in the context of assuming the goer to be real, and a general discussion to the effect that word meanings are not necessarily, you know, entities existing at that time in the outside world. There, one could read references to Nagarjuna's school rather than any particular work of Nagarjuna in other references, especially in the vritti part of Bhartrhari's work. He distinguishes between Trayantavid and Kshanikavadin. Though Trayantavid is those who represent the Vedic tradition. And Kshanikavadins are, of course, the Buddhists in general. And at one point, he shows how the two are really, you know, this particular very important pronouncement of Nagarjuna, that in effect, that we cannot talk in a logically consistent, meaningful way about existence. In the world coming into existence, whatever we do, we give rise to another unintended implication. That is pointed out, and it said the followers of the Vedic tradition speak of an unchanging universal self, whereas the followers of the certain schools of Buddhist tradition speak of sequence itself being the constant factor instead of an entity, the chain sequence, it's itself. And there one sees that he's trying to get one level above that would accommodate both the views, and say sort of not contradicting each other. We get a glimpse of what
that reference would apply to other Buddhists.
Yes, that's why it's not. Yeah. Correct, you're right. So we don't really have much evidence, but the commentators indicate that Bhartrihari was aware of Nagarjuna. For example, the oldest commentator, Vrishabha, he quotes the first Karika, in explaining Sarvatmana Nairatmyam. There is a view that, Sarvatmana Nairatmyam, that's referred to in the Vritti. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How serious do you think he took him? Well, sometimes you say, okay, so there's this objection, but this is obviously forward, or you would say, okay, this is actually a severe problem we have to deal with. So is there any evidence you think for...
Oh, probably Bhartrihari took him very seriously. That is, he has great respect for Buddhist philosophers. Mm. And his point has been that these philosophers do not realize that to a great extent they are talking past each other. That's his way of looking at the thing. So he is not there, upholding one side and putting down another side. That's not his method. So I would imagine he had much respect, and he would have said, yes, at a higher level, saying something like Sarvatmana Nairatmyam is very important. So he would say, philosophically, I don't think the method is right, but the message is extremely important. Mm. That would be his basis for respect. Mm. Yes, please, person.
Krishna catches to wonder where a Jain thinker, Kundakunda, would fit in this process.
Kundakunda is one of the early ones. That is, his dating differs from, 3rd century is the earliest I have seen. Now, there is no awareness of the Jains clearly reflected in Bhartrihari's thinking. Of course, the Saptabhangi, Syadvada, collectively, they can be made to interpret, they can be made to convey the same message, yes. But... there is no clear recognition of the Jains in Bhartrihari's writing, as far as I could see. Umaswati would be another possibility, but Umaswati could be later. Kundakunda is really a challenge. That is, yes.
Yes.
Correct. But again, language is not the main concern. It's just argumentation is somewhat similar. That's true.
Yeah. You mentioned a number of general, dispositions in Indian thought that predispose that you focus on language. How, in the West, at least in Western philosophy, that how much evidence is there that Bhartrihari continued to influence Indian philosophy and continues to do it?
Very, very good question. For 300-400 years, definitely a lot of influence. Many of those texts have been lost, we can surmise from what has been left behind. But Dignaga is a prime example of influence of Bhartrihari. That is, he takes over some parts of Bhartrihari's work, makes a few changes here and there. And, Traikalya Pariksha is a kind of re-edited Sambandha Samuddesha that you see. So, yes, definitely. Up to Shantarakshita's time, you do see a very strong engagement with Bhartrihari's thought. From the Mimamsa side, Kumarila engages in debates with him. From the Buddhist side, there is more of an interest. Then, as you see, with the political upheavals in India, all philosophical literature, except at the extremities of Nepal, Tibet, etc., has suffered. So we, after the 11th, 12th century, we do see Bhartrhari not being known at first hand. We begin to suspect that somehow he was no longer a part of the curriculum for advanced philosophers and so on. But that's happened to many other branches of learning and specialization in India, because the traditional patronage for learning was gone. Especially Buddhism suffered very heavily in this period.
For Dignaga, pratyaksha, or direct experience of an object, is language defying. As soon as we say I am Gataha, then we're distorting the nature of that experience by superimposing a concept onto it which is not derived from that experience. And for Bhartrhari, all consciousness is permeated by language. So for me, those seem like two, as far away from each other as you could get. Where's the influence from Bhartrhari to Dignaga?
Well, the fact that we cannot speak of anything without distortion, that is common to both. That is, when you say I am Ghataha, you have, in Bhartrhari's way of systematizing, you have blocked off the realization of some other ways in which the Ghata could have been approached. So a thing is a bundle of capacities for him, and every time a single capacity, a power, you might say, capability rather than capacity, is activated. Okay, so this is one way of looking at it. A thing in its fullness is never expressible. A thing without some kind of distortion is never expressible, which where Dignaga would agree with him. That is, when you say I am Ghataha, you have brought in the singular number, a sense of masculinity, with which we are not really concerned. That is, all you wanted to do was to say that assert the existence of the pot. That is the intention, but the experience is expressed with the unnecessary and unintended limitation of singularity, etc. So some kind of subtle distortion always takes place.
And then of these two currents in East and Western philosophy, do you think that then these two chapters of Eastern and Western philosophy are more similar than that frequently stated difference implies?
You see, first of all, I said these are broad similarities. That is, and I'm not a specialist of history of Western philosophy. This is based on very relatively superficial knowledge I have. But what you say is not necessary. Does not necessarily follow. That is, if you think of Indian philosophy as something what we in North America call a duplex. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the term? Two houses that are joined to each other, which you have row houses here. You take, instead of thinking of a number of houses, think of only two. And we have single family dwellings, we have row houses, and we have duplexes, which is in between. Now, this duplex, if
twin houses.
Anyway, if you think of concern with transforming the subject as the second house, then all the developments I spoke about are taking place in the first house. They are not necessarily contradicting the other. We can raise an important question: should Western philosophy remain satisfied with what it's doing? Should it not really wonder about the transformative aspects also? That would be all right. But in the first one, these very rigorously argued discussions are taking place. It would not necessarily affect these different starting point that philosophy should have a purpose of some sort. I don't see why it should. If I have misunderstood you, please correct.
Maybe taking up a similar question, in the history of Western thought, and people like Hume and then Kant, and I think also seeing from what you said, in a lot of similarities with this notion of time and space as inherent principles in language, they were seen as a threat to religion. The Enlightenment, this time, was seen as
Do we have a? Yes. Well, there's another reservation, it seems. Oh, I see. Okay. Anyway. So we meet, so we'll talk about it.
Thank you very much, and thanks, Professor. This is his last lecture.
Okay.